In any case, I'm going to try tonight to pull together different elements of what we've been talking about. I'm calling tonight's class, if we can, Empire Building and Decolonization, with a special focus on Africa. We've touched on the Middle East. Last week we looked at Latin America. We've been trying to situate ourselves in North America in terms of some conception of the West and how we fit into that conception in this part of the world. So tonight I want to focus especially on Africa. Empire building and decolonization, in a sense, this is the core concept when it comes to how I'm seeing globalization. And I've explained that in different ways. Empire building, especially European empire building after 1492, I see as the most dynamic agency of globalization, the most powerful instrument of communications, creating communications networks that pull people into a increasingly large and many faceted network or networks of interaction, of interactivity. There's an image that I've been wanting to put up for some time, which I think is an interesting counterpoint to imperialism and imperial globalization. This is a text written in 1375. Legendary people depicted in a French manuscript typify fanciful European concepts of the inhabitants of unknown lands. One has his face on his chest, another a foot large enough to shade himself from the sun, a third a single eye. Fables of such odd beings often place them in Asia, a continent thought to have great wealth, magic, and many natural wonders. So here's depictions of how human beings are in different parts of the world, as it was seen before 1492. So the idea that human beings share a common character, personality, that we are much the same, that we don't have these massive differences among us in different parts of the world. This is not to be taken for granted. This is a fairly new idea in human history. So empire building, this is a powerful image of imperialists looking at China, and it's a depiction of imperial vampires. France, England, Russia, Japan, and Germany get their claws into China. And it's from around 1900, so there's Japan, and there is the Germans, and there is the French, and there is the English, and there is Russia. It's a very dark image of imperialism and the voraciousness of imperialism. On the other hand, here's a celebration of Queen Victoria's 60th anniversary as the imperial monarch of the British Empire. Contained troops of every color, every continent, every race. So here is the 60th anniversary of Queen Victoria's reign. And Victoria became a kind of image or symbolism of imperialism. Here's a map of Africa. And this is the British Empire as it was in 1920, British Africa and the Middle East in 1920. And so you can see a big part of Africa is part of the British Empire and also the Middle East, Iraq, trusteeship over Palestine, and of course we learned about how the Balfour Declaration in 1917 established the basis of a Jewish homeland, which would become Israel in 1948. Here's another image of the British Empire. I recall these as a child, seeing these types of depictions quite often. Here's an image of the different military bases, naval bases supporting the worldwide military network of the British Empire. So this image of imperialism, this account of imperialism has figured largely and prominently in the study we've done to date. Tonight I want to focus on a particular book. And it's by Martin Meredith, The Fate of Africa, From the Hopes of Freedom to the Heart of Despair, A History of 50 Years of Independence. And I found this quite fascinating. It's clarified a lot of issues that I had some inkling of an understanding of, but it's given a lot more depth. I traveled in Central Africa and East Africa when I was 19, 20 years old. I worked for a documentary crew. I happened to meet them in the airport in Nairobi, and they were filming the East African Safari Rally. It was a French documentary firm documenting Datsun Motors' contribution to the East African Safari Rally. And so that was a time when Japan was just starting to come on with its automotive products. They had the 240Z. They cleaned up. They beat everybody by a long shot. In any case, that was I was 19, 20 years old, traveling in Uganda, Kenya, Congo, and I'd have to say it was one of the great adventures of my life. So some of these issues I reflect back, and of course I was young and didn't understand a lot of history in those days, but it's interesting to look back and think about what you were seeing. I was traveling in this area in here, and I'm going to focus tonight, at least in the first half, on a particular study of the Belgian Congo and the decolonization of the Belgian Congo. But let's just take a brief survey of Africa as it was in 1955. So all these areas that are shaded in represent parts of Africa that are under European domination. So the British, the French, the Belgians, the Portuguese, the Spanish, the Italians. Much of Africa south of the Sahara was divided in the late 19th century, and there was a kind of scramble for colonies in Africa. In 1955, there was Egypt. There were very few parts of Africa that had some degree of independence. Egypt had been basically under the authority of Great Britain, although it was informal. King Farouk, there was a some kind of a monarchy that asserted some kind of jurisdiction, and it was pretty much a puppet regime of a puppet government under British control. And the British, of course, were very very zealous in protecting the Suez Canal, which was a link to India, which dramatically shortened the route to India. And of course, it increasingly became a key to importing oil from the Middle East into Europe. So in the early 1950s, an army general or an army official by the name of Nasser took over. There was a plot from within the army, and the British puppet regime was displaced by a very nationalistic regime in Egypt. Egypt and the British Empire kind of shared jurisdiction over Sudan. There was an ancient monarchy in Ethiopia with Emperor Haile Selassie governing Ethiopia. And Liberia is a very interesting case where Liberia was created as a jurisdiction to receive freed slaves. So there was some degree of concern in the United States that these freed slaves would set a bad example. How would you maintain slavery when there was the example of freed slaves? So Liberia was created as a place to take American blacks, or to encourage American blacks to settle there. It became an extremely violent regime in recent years. If any of you saw A Lord of War with Nicolas Cage, it's an excellent movie. It's about the small arms trade, and it does a kind of expose of Liberia, and it demonstrates that the small arms trade to Africa is responsible for a huge bloodbath in that continent, which goes on to this day. That was not formally a colony, was the Union of South Africa, which received a kind of independence from Great Britain in 1910. But only the whites had the vote in that Union of South Africa. And so the white minority regime opposed the kind of decolonization that was being extended to the rest of Africa. And that created a very bitter situation in that part of Africa. Of course, when you think of the way the British Empire was organized, part of the empire covers territories where indigenous peoples are in the majority, and part of the empire covers territories where it's predominantly European settlers and their descendants. These are sometimes known as the white dominions. So Australia, New Zealand, Canada are obviously part of that. And South Africa felt itself, the white settlers in that part of the world felt themselves to be in that category, a white dominion. But of course, the majority population were not white. The majority population are black, are indigenous peoples from that part of the territory. So those are the parts of Africa that are not colonies. But now let's look at the majority of the lands. If we go back to the document camera, that of course there is a large area of northwestern Africa, which is under French jurisdiction. And, of course, Algeria is going to prove to be a particularly contentious part of this zone. The French Empire gave up much of its
gave up its colonies in Southeast Asia. One of those colonies was Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia. And of course, the United States took over the imperial role that France had in Vietnam after 1954, with the view that if they didn't step in, that area would fall to communism. France, however, was very adamant. The French people and the French government were very adamant that they weren't going to withdraw from Algeria. Algeria was seen as actually part of France, was organized as part of France. And the French Empire was quite different in its structure than the British Empire. The French Empire encouraged a kind of assimilation, a kind of civilizational mission, where it encouraged the elites in these communities to think of themselves as French citizens. And they were represented, these territories were represented in the French Parliament. And there was a view that you should try to identify your identity, your culture, your language with the culture of France. So when the Algerian war was going poorly, with the contention over the future of Algeria, and it became a violent struggle, de Gaulle was brought back into power with the view that he would preserve Algeria for France. So that part of Africa was the zone of extreme contention between 1956 and 1962. Here's Nasser with somebody we'll be discussing tonight, Nkrumah, Kwame Nkrumah. And well, let's read the a family affair. Nkrumah pictured with his friend Colonel Nasser in 1966. In his first year as Ghana's leader, Nkrumah asked Nasser for help in finding a wife. Nkrumah eventually chose an Egyptian woman he did not meet until his wedding day. So Nasser, who I discussed a few moments ago, Nasser, of course, is trying to generate Arab unity, pan-Arab unity, but he also sees himself as playing a major role in Africa as a kind of sponsor of decolonization in Africa. And here he is with Nkrumah, Kwame Nkrumah, who is the leader of decolonization in Gold Coast, which becomes known as Ghana. So the Gold Coast would become Ghana. The British colonies included Nigeria. Nigeria, which is an oil-rich country, is a very complex ethnic community. There's many ethnic groups, many distinct languages in Nigeria. And there's a big part in the north, which is primarily Muslim. It's proven to be an extremely difficult country to govern. There is really no Nigerian identity before the British imposed their imperial system. The British are in Kenya, Uganda. That's the territory that I traveled in 1970-71. And I got into Congo. And I'll discuss that. But it occurred to me recently that I was there not too many years after Che Guevara went to that part of the world from Cuba, with the view that he was going to urge on and help on a revolution against imperialism, an international revolution. And so the Cubans would play a very major role in African politics, especially when it came to the decolonization of the Portuguese colonies, Angola and Mozambique. And Portugal was the last of the European powers to give up its colonies. It didn't give up Macau in China until 1999. And so Angola and Mozambique would prove to be areas of extreme contention in the Cold War. And Rhodesia, of course, would be a zone of great contention. Rhodesia, named after Cecil Rhodes, the British imperialist who promoted the mining industry in that part of the world. And of course, the Italians have a long history of involvement in Africa, especially the Maghrib, going back to the days of the Roman Empire, for that matter. But they're quite involved in Somalia, in Ethiopia. So this is the zone that we're going to focus on tonight. Although I do want to talk about different ways of thinking about empire, different approaches to empire. But I thought I would start with a case study of Patrice Lumumba, the first Prime Minister of Congo. And Patrice Lumumba was removed from office very early on, was considered to be flirting with communism, was ruthlessly, violently murdered, and in his place, an army general was set up. Mobutu is his name, and he renamed himself Sese Seko and renamed the Congo Zaire. If I can read this caption here, the Congo 1960, his arms rope behind him, the Congo's ousted Prime Minister, Patrice Lumumba, is hauled off to prison after being captured by Colonel Mobutu's troops. "If I die, tant pis," he told a friend. "The Congo needs martyrs." Badly beaten, he was executed by a firing squad in Katanga under the command of a Belgian officer. So, the chapter devoted to this account of what went on in the Congo is called Heart of Darkness. And Heart of Darkness, of course, is the name of a novel by Joseph Conrad. And I brought it in with me. I don't see it easily accessible right at the moment. I'll find it presently. But Heart of Darkness, how many of you have heard of or have read Heart of Darkness? Yeah, I remember reading it in high school. It was Yeah, it's the basis for Apocalypse Now. I remember that book and Death of a Salesman from those plays you did in high school. It's a very dark, ominous account written by Joseph Conrad. Joseph Conrad actually was a steamboat driver on the Congo River in the days of Leopold. So I thought we'd just go through some of this text, and I'd connect this text to other texts. Here's another picture of Patrice Lumumba when he's taken into custody. So there's a general agreement on the part of the United States, CIA, the government of Belgium, and his opponents in Congo that Lumumba had to go. Lumumba had to be eliminated. And so here he is, Prime Minister of his country, handed over essentially to his enemies within the Congo. And he was in his 30s when he became Prime Minister. So in the speech where Congo became independent, And there was a flurry of passing over the power from these European empires to different governments in Africa, especially in 1960. There was about 25 of these African colonies that became countries in 1960. And Belgium very quickly responded to this with its own independence movement. The official from the Congolese government referred to Leopold II, who created the Free Congo State. This Belgian official said, the independence of Congo constitutes the culmination of the work conceived by the genius of Leopold II, undertaken by him with a tenacious courage and continued with perseverance with Belgium. So this characterization of Leopold II was seen as an outrage by some of the Congolese members present. Patrice Lumumba, who was more or less self-educated, who came up through the postal workers' union in Congo, responded with his own impromptu speech, and he said at this independence ceremony event, "We have known sarcasm and insults, endured blows morning, noon, and night, because we were niggers. We've seen our lands despoiled under the terms of what was supposedly the law of the land, but which only recognized the right of the strongest. We've seen that the law was quite different for a white than for a black, accommodating for the former, cruel and inhumane for the latter. We've seen the terrible suffering of those banished to remote regions because of their political opinions or religious beliefs, exiled within their own country. Their fate was truly worse than death itself. And finally, who can forget the volleys of gunfire in which so many of our brothers perish, the cells where the authorities threw those who would not submit to a rule where justice meant oppression and exploitation." So this is obviously was a very different view of things than recognizing the genius of Leopold. If we go to the account given in the text by Martin Meredith, let's pick up his account of some of this history and then look at this history from other angles as well. In 1885, after much maneuvering, Leopold attained international approval for his personal empire, calling it the Congo Free State. It was an area of nearly 1 million square miles, 75 times the size of Belgium and 1/13th of the African continent. It included a web of interconnecting rivers navigable by steamboat running deep into the interior and a wealth of resources such as ivory, palm oil, timber, and copper. Pondering a choice of title for himself, Leopold at first considered Emperor of the Congo, but he eventually settled for the more modest King Sovereign. I dropped into Congo, and it hadn't yet changed its name to Zaire, in 1971, and it was a remarkably rich part of the world. Every kind of natural resource you could imagine, you know, from diamonds to manganese, very rare minerals. In that part of the world, there is apparently one geographic formation which produces a certain mineral which you need for cell phones. And you can only get this mineral from that one place. So you can imagine what the control of that one place means. The part of the world where I was has gone into the most crazy conflagrations between competing armies and militias. Part of that, of course, was the outrage in Rwanda, where Hutus murdered Watutsis. Watutsis were seen by the Belgians, by the French, by the different imperial powers as a kind of master race, and they were given authority over other peoples in the days of European imperialism. And the resentments were huge emerging from that time. And in any case, when I was in Rwanda, it's a beautiful part of the world, part of this area that is rich in natural resources. So if we go back, Leopold's next fortune after ivory from the tusks of elephants, with the invention of the pneumatic tire fitted first to bicycles and then to motor cars in the 1990s, demand for rubber and the price of it soared. Using a system of slave labor, concession companies, sharing the profits with Leopold, he stripped the Congo's equatorial forests of all the wild rubber that they could lay their hands on, imposing quotas on villagers and taking hostages when necessary. It goes on to describe the growth in that industry, 100 tons of rubber in 1890, in 1901, 6,000 tons of rubber. So the beginning of the automotive age, the beginning of the use of bicycles and then cars in the early 20th century created a huge market, a huge demand for rubber, which now is synthetic, but in those days was coming directly from rubber trees, from the sap of rubber trees. But Leopold's regime provoked uprisings and revolt and left behind a landscape of burned villages, terrified refugees, starvation and disease. Ultimately, his rule came to depend on the force publique, an army composed of white officers and African auxiliaries, notorious for its brutal conduct. By the end of his 23-year reign as King Sovereign, Leopold had become one of the richest men in Europe. But the Congo had lost several million people, possibly as many as 10 million, half of its population. In an essay on exploration, Joseph Gonrad described the activities of Leopold's Congo Free State as the vilest scramble for the loot that ever disfigured the history of human conscience. So we're looking at a crime against humanity of comparable magnitude to Hitler's assault on Jews, homosexuals, and gypsies in the Second World War. This is a crime against humanity on a vast scale, conducted by Leopold, who became a kind of proxy for the United States in a way. It's a fascinating account, which we'll go into presently, of how Leopold acquired this empire in the middle of Africa. Here's a depiction of the Congo Free State. So you can see it's basically the drainage basin of the Congo River, which is one of the world's largest rivers. This territory he acquired more or less as his personal proprietary domain. In other words, he owned this territory, so he structured the law and its resources. And obviously, he considered the resources to include the human beings. And so it does represent a kind of modern-day return to a form of slavery. So let's see how this history is depicted in Adam Hochschild's King Leopold's Ghost, a story of greed, terror, and heroism in colonial Africa. And it's published by a Hot Mifflin Company in Boston. And it's first published in 1998. So here is Leopold as a young man. Of course, Belgium was not seen as an imperial country. Leopold played on that. This area was supposedly discovered by Henry Morton Stanley. Here he is. He traveled up the Congo and made treaties with the indigenous peoples. He depicted himself as an American, although he was actually from Britain. And the United States actually considered his expedition as vesting title or vesting jurisdiction in the Congo Basin, based on the doctrine of discovery. And the doctrine of discovery was still alive and well in this time period, the late 19th century. Lewis and Clark, of course, had deployed the doctrine of discovery when they went up the Missouri River and across the Pacific to the across the Rocky Mountains to the Pacific. The Corps of Exploration used this doctrine to justify the claims, the U.S. claims. Interestingly, of course, Lewis and Clark were latecomers. The Northwest Company had been well down in there, and so it was a pretty bogus claim. And of course, the whole concept of discovery is a pretty bogus concept, because of course it completely precludes recognition and appreciation of the indigenous peoples. And of course, how can something be discovered when people are already there? But of course, it makes an assumption about certain kind of people as being more advanced, more civilized than other kind of people.